Tuesday, September 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Biden rails against the president's attack, saying Trump can't stop the violence that he himself has been stoking.
These are not images of some imagined Joe Biden America in the future. These are images of Donald Trump's America today.
President Trump threatens to take federal action in the city of Portland after months of protests over racial injustice. Also ahead, Lady Gaga dominates the MTV Music Awards and in true Gaga fashion brings a message through what she wore. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump has continued his accusations that protests in cities in the nation are the fault of Democrats.
The wave of violence and destruction that we've seen in recent weeks and months has occurred in cities exclusively controlled and dominated by the Joe Biden party. If you take a look, the top 10 in the country are Democrats. It's Democrat-run cities, and it's a shame, and it can be solved so easy.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is calling the violence at protests in Portland, Oregon, and other places unacceptable and challenged President Trump to stop, quote, recklessly encouraging it after one person was killed in Portland during clashes between rival groups over the weekend.
He's supposed to be protecting his country, but instead he's rooting for chaos and violence. The simple truth is, Donald Trump failed to protect America. So now he's trying to scare America.
Demonstrations against racism and police brutality have swept the United States since the death in May of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man who died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Biden says the American public knows he's not the pro-violence person President Trump is making him out to be.
Trump and Pence are running on this, and I find it fascinating. Quote, you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America. And what's their proof? The violence we're seeing in Donald Trump's America. These are not images of some imagined Joe Biden America in the future. These are images of Donald Trump's America today.
At a news conference Monday, President Trump addressed last week's deadly shooting of protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin. AP correspondent Mike Grossier reports.
At a news conference late Monday, President Donald Trump appeared to defend Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old from Illinois charged with fatally shooting two protesters and wounding another in Kenosha, Wisconsin last week.
He was trying to get away from them, I guess, it looks like. And he fell, and then they very violently attacked him.
Trump continued.
I guess he was in very big trouble. He probably would have been killed, but it's under investigation.
Trump is scheduled to visit Kenosha Tuesday. Mike Grossia, Washington.
Joining us now to discuss all of the latest tensions is Mark Rozelle, Dean of the Schar School of Government and Policy at George Mason University in Virginia. Thank you so much for being with us. What's your view on this law and order strategy by President Trump and in general what's been happening here?
The message is resonating primarily with the president's base, and he understands that he has to ratchet up their turnout significantly given the math of the Electoral College and what the polls are showing right now that Joe Biden retains a lead. But where I think it's trickier for the president is expanding beyond his base using this law and order theme. That has worked sometimes in the past. It could be, as some have said, a kind of scare tactic, right? That there's disorder in the American cities and he's going to tell people he's going to send some federal officers in the cities, do something to make a show that he's cracking down on disorder in the streets. That all plays into the incumbency advantage that presidents naturally have when running for re-election. Joe Biden, he can talk about what he would do differently, but it's not really the same as the president taking some kind of firm action, at least as the public might perceive it.
It seems that he literally been supportive of this so-called caravan of his supporters that drove into Portland over the weekend, where one person actually ended up being shot to death. So far, he hasn't really backed down in support of those people, tweeting that they're patriots.
Well, certainly the president should be addressing the causes of the protest, but I think more so he is engaging in a kind of partisan one-upmanship here. Usually what happens is that when things are going bad in the country, the incumbent president, whether fair or not, tends to take most of the blame, but the president has been shifting the blame to Democratic Party leaders in America's major cities and mid-sized cities and elsewhere that there have been these protests. So it's a way for the president to try to shift blame away from himself, even though he's the person in charge and all of this is taking place under his watch, and to characterize this as something that's the fault of state and local leaders, primarily city mayors who happen to be Democrats, turning it into an entirely partisan issue rather than trying to find a way to ratchet down the intensity of anger that's out there right now on both sides. I would think a responsible president would do more to try to bring down the temperature that's out there in the country right now, but perhaps he sees something of a partisan advantage in stoking some of the conflict that's out there at this time.
Joe Biden came out on Monday pretty strongly against the president, saying that he's the one that's stoking the violence and he's making up lies about him. Was Joe Biden's message effective in countering the attacks against him?
Biden's tactic there, I think, was quite effective in appealing to swing voters and the many Americans who right now want some calm in the country and want to turn down the heat, the partisan polarization, the intensity of anger that's out there. And so Biden knows that he has the ability to be a calming influence, that people tend to see him as stable, non-confrontational in his style. And he wants to portray that he's more of a unifying type figure in American politics, as opposed to the president of the United States, who he has characterized, and many others believe is correct, as somebody who intensifies the dissension that's out there in the country right now and is stoking a lot of the anger that's out in the streets right now. So to me, it was the right thing for Biden to do, to project the image of a calming influence, somebody who can turn down the temperature in the country, someone who is not looking to intensify partisan polarization to try to bring people together. I think that's the right message, and a lot of Americans are looking for that right now in their leadership.
How does a new president or a current president strike a balance, assuring the public that they are looking out for safety and, of course, still supporting the police while not avoiding the issues of systemic racism that have been plaguing the country and the reason for all these protests all these months?
That's a tough question. It really is, because protests are reflecting an underlying discontent with features of our system and our society. The protests have brought to the fore enormous discontents over issues of equity, fairness, racial justice, and the like. And we've been dealing with these complex issues for generations, of course, but we've hit a kind of boiling point where people are saying enough is enough. Things have to change. So let's say Joe Biden becomes the president-elect. It's going to put a lot of pressure on him to make some major moves early in his new administration to try to deal with systemic racism and injustices in this society, all the things that are bringing about protest movements and demands for change in our society. You know, we're having a very tough conversation in this country right now, how best to move forward and overcome injustices. And it's not an easy conversation. And I think it's going to be a very difficult task for the new president, should it be Joe Biden, to form a consensus in this society about what really needs to be done to make progress. And don't discount the possibility, by the way, that if defeated for re-election, Donald Trump continues to hold rallies, for example, keeping his movement activated and trying to influence a certain core of public opinion that looks to him for leadership and is going to be extremely oppositional to whatever Joe Biden and the Democrats try to do should there be Democratic leadership beginning in 2021. So I don't think the issues are easy. They're going to be extremely difficult, but they're difficult because we've left them on the floor for so long, now saying we have to start making progress.
Mark Rozelle, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. With mass protests in Belarus showing no sign of let-up following contested presidential elections August 9th, the country's longtime leader, Alexander Lukashenko, is turning to Russia for his political survival. But behind the Kremlin's response lies a mix of geopolitical and domestic concerns, as Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
In Belarus, mass protests calling for free elections amid threats of a police crackdown have inspired pro-democracy activists around the globe. But Russia's government has cast a more cautious eye at events unfolding across its border. Similar to longtime leader Alexander Lukashenko, Russian President Vladimir Putin has dominated national politics for over two decades. And last week, the Russian leader signaled the Kremlin was ready to intervene on behalf of Lukashenko's government to keep the country under Russian influence if necessary.
Alexander Grigorievich asked me to create a reserve police force for him, so I did. We also agreed that it would not be used unless the situation gets out of control.
Behind Putin's calculus lie geopolitical interests, but also concerns over how the Belarusian pro-democracy movement could echo at home, say analysts.
On the one hand, it could be contagion, infection, political infection, which could come from Belarus to Russia. But at the same time, we have our own infection in that sense. I'm in Khabarovsk.
Thousands in Khabarovsk, in Russia's Far East, have led a weeks-long protest following the arrest and removal of a popular local governor by the Kremlin on murder charges dating back more than a decade. Demonstrators have taken up the cause of the Belarusian opposition movement in solidarity. The alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny during a trip to Siberia earlier this month has further fueled anger against Putin. The Kremlin has resisted calls to launch a criminal investigation, arguing conclusions about Navalny's poisoning are premature. While Navalny's supporters argue the opposition leader's sudden illness is the latest sign Russia's political system is as rigid and violent as their neighbors in Belarus. Navalny had been working to get out the vote for government opponents in Russian regional elections scheduled September 9th. But with support for Putin's ruling party, United Russia, at a low ebb, rival candidates are already expressing concern Belarus may cast an unwelcome shadow over the vote count.
It's not even, they don't ask whether there'll be fraud. Everybody is certain whether there will be fraud. What the big question is, they say, is there going to be fraud Belarusian style?
Lukashenko's claim of a landslide victory with 80% of the vote helped trigger public outrage and an unfolding political crisis. As Russians prepare to head to the polls in difficult times, public faith in the results may determine the degree to which Belarus is or is not a harbinger of things to come. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
Across Africa, more than 140 million children are out of school amid coronavirus-related closures. Of those, 14 million are in South Africa, which also is the continent's viral hotspot. In September, after several attempts at closing, then reopening, then reclosing schools, the nation's school system is now trying to open for real this time. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
After 5 months of uncertainty and home learning, South Africa is going back to school. The nation closed its 23,000 government schools in March as part of a 9-week lockdown to try to stop the viral spread. They reopened in June, briefly, and then closed again when infection spiked. Most recently, the school system took a 4-week break, sending some 14 million students back home, with plans to resume nationwide in early September. President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Cabinet has decided today that all public schools should take a break for the next 4 weeks. Now, this has also been the experience in a number of other countries, where schools have opened and have also had to close due to the circumstances that each country has had to confront.
A recent survey by the World Health Organization found that schools are fully open in only 6 of 39 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. South Africa is among about a dozen countries that plan to resume in-person learning in September. The WHO and the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund support the reopening of African schools, with UNICEF reporting that the incidence of violence against children has risen since schools were closed. During the closures, nutrition rates have fallen, with more than 10 million children missing school meals. The UN agencies have published health guidelines that they hope will help schools reopen safely. But education experts say this is no ordinary school year. Professor Labi Ramarthan is an education specialist at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa.
I think the first thing is to recognize that this entire academic year is going to be a disruptive year, that there is no good, there's not going to be a continuous schooling until the pandemic is almost over, because when individuals are infected, the school closes. There's protocols are put in place to bring back the safety of the schools. So we're going to consistently experience this. So as if I was the Minister of Education, I would begin to review what is being taught. I would look at the CAPS curriculum. I would work with teachers, senior teachers, and subscriptivizes to say, what are the core learnings that we can expose our learners to?
And in that way, he says, this pandemic could present a unique opportunity.
What we need to focus is on to say, how is the learning that they're going to receive right now relevant to them? And that requires almost a review of what we teach in schools and make it relevant to them right now. We shouldn't be focusing on summative examination to say whether the students can progress to the next level or that they will lose out an entire academic year. But we should focus on bits of learning, the units of learning, that we can even assess to test the competences at that level.
The school closures have created other unforeseen opportunities. Recent education graduate Zafira Ahmad built a private teaching business with 7 students between the ages of 3 and 8. Some will return to full-time school, others won't. She acknowledges that her fee, which is about $12 an hour, is out of reach for many South African parents in a country where the minimum wage stands at about $1.20 an hour. She says she sympathizes with the decisions teachers are making right now.
Yeah, I am concerned about contracting the virus, but at the same time, I'm also concerned about the education of children and them lagging behind being out of school. And for me, that concern outweighs the concern of actually getting the virus.
Ahmad says she would much prefer to teach at an actual school and for things to be normal again. But for now, she says she's focused on keeping her students learning. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Major mosques and churches reopened in Cairo over the weekend after more than 5 months of being shut down. This comes as the number of Egypt's new COVID-19 cases rise again after weeks of decline. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Istanbul with Hamada El Rassam in Cairo.
Only a handful of people in this crowded church are wearing masks, despite the priest imploring worshippers to take precautions against the coronavirus. After the service, 32-year-old Mosa Nazmi says he thinks more people came out to pray than normal, supposing the pandemic has led many to contemplate mortality. But he says he is surprised people didn't take more precautions. Across town, at the Al-Azhar Mosque, the coronavirus procedure was more strict when they opened for prayers on Friday. Worshippers wore masks and carried their own prayer rugs, setting them up about a meter away from each other. In recent weeks, counts of new COVID-19 cases have been going down in Egypt. But this trend reversed last week with an average of 180 new cases per day. And some Egyptians fear that reopening places of worship sends a message to the public that could lead to a disastrous resurgence of the virus. Mohamed Osam is a 29-year-old photographer taking pictures of old and abandoned buildings in Cairo. He says it's not just mosques and churches he's worried about as cafes, trains, and other businesses reopen. And like many places around the world, he says Egypt is emerging from lockdowns without knowing if or when people will be safe. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul, with Hamada El Rassam in Cairo.
Top aides to President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in the United Arab Emirates on a historic flight from Tel Aviv on Monday to finalize a pact marking open relations between the Gulf power and Israel. But before discussions started in Abu Dhabi, the delegates made aviation history when the Israeli commercial airliner flew over Saudi territory on the direct flight from Tel Aviv to the UAE capital. Joining us to talk about it is Harry Rees, Director of Policy and Strategy at the New Israel Fund. Tell us a bit about where you see this and the potential significance of this.
The first among them is that the Israel-UAE normalization deal is explicitly tied to Israel's foregoing its unilateral annexation of the West Bank. In other words, it's an affirmation that there can't be any kind of peace or normalization with annexation. And while Netanyahu has hailed the deal as a historic peace agreement, it's actually not comparable to any of the historic peace deals reached by his predecessors, Menachem Begin or Yitzhak Rabin, who really brought an end to decades of hostilities with neighbors. While Netanyahu fashioned some himself a peacemaker. The UAE and Israel were never in a technical state of war. And the decision to normalize ties builds on decades of covert cooperation, which, while they should be celebrated, is hardly a peace accord. And finally, I think it's really important to bear in mind that the deal, which elevates the bilateral relationship, does nothing to resolve the underlying disputes at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That would involve peacemaking, and that would indeed be historic.
So what do they mean when they say historic U.S. brokered deal to normalize relations between the two nations if they weren't in conflict?
Well, certainly this is historic in terms of bilateral relations between Israel and the UAE, and this is the third Arab government that has formally normalized relations after Egypt and Jordan. And 79% of Israelis did prefer normalization with UAE over annexation, and there are certainly benefits in it. But there are no streamers in the streets, and few Israelis, I think, are elated by the formalization of relations in the way that they were when Menachem Begin made peace with Egypt, when the unthinkable came to pass. By contrast, as Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky has pointed out, when Anwar Sadat got on a plane to the Ben Gurion airport, grown men cried, men who'd fought, who'd lost friends, brothers to Egypt. That's not the case today.
Why is that?
The reason is because the deal that's on the table, essentially normalization between Israel and the UAE in exchange for a pause, a suspension of Israeli annexation, and some military equipment for the UAE, doesn't bring to an end the core disputes at the heart of the Israeli-Arab and Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is a type of partnership that's already existed, that's been public knowledge for many years now among Israelis. There are certainly benefits in terms of tourism and trade. There are Israelis and Emiratis that stand to benefit from this deal, but it isn't historic enemies that are reaching a peace that requires deep compromise.
Do you think that it moves the goalpost closer to a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, or does it make it more difficult?
So in the first sense, I think the fact that the normalization agreement puts Israeli plans for unilateral annexation of the West Bank on ice, that is helpful. That is a necessary requirement for moving forward any future peace between Israelis and Palestinians. You can't have peace with annexation. So that's number one. Number two is that the way that Netanyahu has been trying to sell this deal politically to his domestic political base is as proof that Israelis never need to make concessions to Palestinians in exchange for normalization with an Arab state. This is a case he's been making for 25 years, as he said today in a press conference, since Oslo. His effort has been to dismantle the idea that Israel has to make concessions for peace. And I think that's a very dangerous illusion. In order for Israel to reach a final status agreement with Palestinians, it must make concessions. And I think Israelis know this. And if there's going to be a silver lining to this moment, it's the possibility, I think, of Israelis seeing that the idea of full normalization with an Arab state is not an illusion, that the images coming out of Abu Dhabi today show that it's a possibility. And that's what lies at the heart of the Arab Peace Initiative, is the offer of full regional normalization with Arab states in exchange for key Israeli concessions necessary to reach a two-state agreement that satisfies Palestinian self-determination. And I think with a different American administration in place, what is happening today isn't inconsistent with starting a real, genuine process, not a kind of sham process that cuts Palestinians out from go, and one that sells annexation as a peace vision.
Harry Reese, Director of Policy and Strategy at the New Israel Fund, thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. A U.S. judge on Monday set a May 2021 trial date for Steve Bannon, a former advisor to President Trump, as well as three co-defendants on charges of defrauding donors in a scheme to build the president's signature wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Lebanon's prime minister-designate Monday called for the formation of a new government in record time and urged immediate reforms as a step toward securing an agreement with the International Monetary Fund. The comments came hours before the arrival of French President Emmanuel Macron, whose pressure on Lebanon's fractious leaders was crucial to forging an agreement. And California fire officials have reported significant headway, battling the two largest of dozens of lightning-sparked wildfires raging in and around the greater San Francisco Bay Area since mid-August. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And to AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Artificial intelligence that automatically detects threatening behavior at train stations is part of a new trial to improve safety for women traveling at night in Australia. Phil Mercer has the story from Sydney.
New South Wales state government says 9 out of 10 Australian women have experienced harassment on the street. It asked researchers to submit ideas to improve safety as part of its Safety After Dark Innovation Challenge. 4 entries have been chosen and will be tested over the next 6 months. One group from the University of Wollongong will develop artificial intelligence software that will examine real-time feeds from security cameras and alert an operator when it detects suspicious activity or an unsafe environment. The AI will be trained to detect people fighting, agitated behaviour, individuals being followed and arguments. The university team says the software is a world first and that they were pushing the limits of the technology. Researcher Elizabeth Muscat, who's a transport planner, is also developing algorithms that create safe routes for female travellers.
It will give women the opportunity to make better informed choices on the routes they choose. So maybe they would choose to take a route that offers them a higher level of passive surveillance, or meaning that a lot more people will be around or businesses will be open. Lighting is improved in that location. The end product could be a mobile application where women can, on their own mobile phones, have a application similar to Google Maps or another route finding app where they could be able to choose which route they want to take home.
Authorities in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, said the range of technology was exciting. Research in 2018 showed that 20% of women in Sydney felt unsafe on public transport. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And Lady Gaga dominated the MTV Video Music Awards show Sunday with a series of visually arresting outfits, masked performances, and 4 wins, including Artist of the Year. Gaga, who went into the show sharing a leading 9 nominations with Ariana Grande, stormed the ceremony with multiple costume changes, ranging from an exotic bird to a bright green ball gown, all accompanied by exaggerated custom-made face masks and muzzles. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day. To try my love and see how well it fits.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.